I think the transformation that comes when a person is drawn into proximity to the presence of God lies in escaping from self-interest into the freedom, the relative freedom of self-forgetfulness. I think the Christian prescription requires a much more radical transformation and reorientation of the human self. And the power to do that must come from beyond, or I guess you could say above, the self, or collectively ourselves.
I'm talking today with Glenn Scorgi, professor of theology at Bethel Seminary. He's a licensed minister of the Baptist General Conference and has served as president of the Canadian Evangelical Theological Association, as well as the Society for the Study of Christian Spirituality. We talked today about a lecture he recently gave at a conference in San Antonio about ways that spirituality has become a widespread cultural phenomenon in recent decades, and about challenges facing Christian spirituality within and outside universities. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. Glenn, when I last saw you, we were in San Antonio at a conference. It's nice to see you today over Zoom. Thank you for your time.
Happy to be here.
So I usually begin these conversations by asking guests how faith figures into their life and work. Now, in your case, I think the answer to that question is pretty obvious, right? You're a theologian and a scholar of Christian spirituality. So let me ask you this question instead. How does your academic work affect your religious life? And has the nature of that influence changed your religious life over time?
Well, I think that we always make quite a presumption when we assume that theologians are into the spiritual life. But thank you for that generous assumption. I do think that my academic life has affected my religious life over the years, perhaps not as much as it should have. But, you know, there are those existential moments in the course of your study where you feel this has implications for how I live. This has implications for my priorities. And now I have to make a very difficult decision. Am I going to move in the direction that the study is pointing, or am I going to resist that, deny that, procrastinate? And that creates its own spiritual crisis. So yes, there have been those moments. I lost a job. I had to leave a job because my academic career had led me to conclusions that were no longer compatible with the confessional statement of that particular group. So it cost me a lot, and I had three young kids at the time. So yes, it has changed. I think over time too, I would say it's affected my spiritual and religious life because I've had such a wide conversation with authors that were far outside my own personal silo. And so it really became by definition a more ecumenical window into Christian life and experience.
That's really fascinating. I know some things about your work and your professional experience. I didn't know you'd left a job over disagreement, because there are also, you know, at BYU, there is a requirement that one be, for us, be worthy of holding a temple recommend, which is a way of saying that you agree with certain confessional tenets of the religion. And I know that it can be a source of some real soul searching for some people who feel out of sorts with certain things in what they're asked to assent to, and the fact that you could leave, I find to be really quite courageous. I find there's a lot of integrity in that. So I like you even more, Glenn, now than I did 5 minutes ago.
Well, I will say that when I was in the throes of this difficult decision that had such great implications for us in our own sense of safety and well-being as a family, there were denominational leaders who told me, just hold your nose and sign the thing for the sake of your ministry. But then I came across this statement in the book of Proverbs that says, "The integrity of the righteous shall guide them, but the wicked will be destroyed by their duplicity." And that haunted me so much that I felt my soul was in peril if I didn't live more authentically with this statement. And I really think that as academics, we should not be so Machiavellian sometimes. I think we need to be pure of heart and let the chips fall where they lie. They usually lie in a better place.
That is, I love that. This is very moving to me. That integrity and that that commitment to your principles, values, biblical, you know, Christian values. I find this to be really great. Thank you for sharing that. Now, I attended this conference that was held at the Oblate School of Theology in San Antonio back in November, and you were there, and you were one of the keynote speakers. And you gave this really great lecture on the state of the academic study of spirituality relative to cultural trends over the past several decades. And your lecture is being published in the journal Spiritus, which is the flagship journal of the Society for the Study of Christian Spirituality, in a couple of months. And I think the several topics in your lecture are of significance and would be of interest to our listeners. So perhaps we can begin with something you address in your introduction in that lecture, which is the dynamic tension between the practice of Christian spirituality and its academic study. Is there a simple way to characterize that tension?
I don't know if it's possible for me to give a simple characterization of that tension, but here are a couple of features of that tension that might be worth noting. The first is that as academics, you know, we like to probe complexity. And I love this quote from Einstein, Albert Einstein, who said, "We should make things simple, but not simpler than they really are." And so academics do complexity. Americans and American culture, and I don't mean to be critical as an outsider, as a documented Canadian, Americans are famously practical and entrepreneurial, and do tend to grow quite impatient with complexity, preferring the simple, even the reductionist, and like to run with that. So I think that there is that tension that's alive between the academy and the practitioners. The other thing I would say, though, is that academic study should never be measured by its practical utility alone. It has intrinsic value. And I'm thinking, for example, of things like the joy of discovery, the contemplation of beauty, the delight of wonder and awe. And this is part of being fully human. And we are called as Christians to live in the light. And so I would say that in defense of the academic side of the utilitarian equation. But I also know, and speaking autobiographically, we academics, if I can be presumptuous enough to include myself in that august group, we academics can be very guilty of hiding in objective detachment.
Yes.
Kind of firewalling ourselves against any obligatory, costly response. And it's also true that as academics, we can harbor rather cold, even narcissist hearts, devoid of empathy and concern, really not that interested in being useful. And so I think that the resolution of the tension is to have a consecrated heart, a heart that is deeply devoted to a cause greater than your own career.
I love that.
And when that heart is in place, then a lot of the tension dissolves.
You know, you're capturing here, Glenn, one of the things I love about the study of Christian spirituality, and that is the way that it does call me to be a better version of my academic self. Right?
Nice, nice. That's good.
Yeah, and to avoid this kind of narcissism you're talking about, and to avoid kind of like the hiding behind presumed objectivity or pure disinterested knowledge. And that's, look, in disinterestedness and objectivity, those are important virtues, you know, to scholarship, but at their extreme, they become a vice. And I've felt that vice weight on me. So I love that you capture that. And it's one of the things that draws me actually to this field that we share. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So you come from the evangelical side of Christianity, and there was an article recently published by David Brooks in the New York Times Magazine.
I love David Brooks, by the way.
Yeah, Dave. No, he's really a very humane writer. Mm. He was a guest at BYU a couple of years ago, actually. Mm. Yeah, mm-hmm. And I had one. His wife, Ann Snyder, was one of our guests on this podcast about a year ago, and she was great. Anyway, Brooks writes in this article, it's an article about the crisis and future of evangelicalism, and he quotes toward its end an evangelical literature professor, Karen Swallow Pryor, mm-hmm. and her line is that modernity has peaked, and Brooks liked that line. Now, you make a similar claim in your lecture. You write there, modernity has had a long run, and I'm wondering if you can explain, you know, kind of what you mean by that, modernity has had a long run, and do you see resurgent interest in spirituality as a reaction against modernity's excesses?
Well, I'll answer the last question first because it's the easiest one to knock off. Yes, I do see the resurgent interest in spirituality as a reaction to, I'd reframe it, not modernity's excesses as much as modernity's spiritual vacuity.
Yeah.
having dismiss that second question, let's go to the first. I affirm my perception that modernity is breaking up. But here's the thing. Some parts of it are surviving better than others.
Yeah, okay.
And the parts that are surviving include the ongoing quest to master nature through science and technology for human comfort, and a persistent emphasis on radical individual autonomy in pursuit of personal comfort and affluence. Now, the other thing I see persisting is this: the classic modern notion of endless progress survives in this sort of perverse way, in an assumption that any reduction in standard of living is absolutely intolerable, even if we must incur massive debt to maintain it. So that's all, to me, surviving vestiges of modernity. The parts of modernity that are in decline, I believe, are, and this is very important, the loss of epistemological confidence, loss that we can know things for sure.
Right.
Or with proper confidence, as Leslie Newbegin calls it, and certainly that we can know anything about the transcendent. So that epistemological loss of confidence, I think, is very important. And then also the loss of optimism with respect to the long-term future. And I think in the decline in epistemological certitude and in the loss of optimism about the future, what we're seeing is almost a reversion or a regression to something that looks like ancient Epicureanism, where you eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die.
Yeah, okay. Modernity, it's important. I mean, in case listeners aren't familiar with the use of that that term, it really is kind of the belief in scientific and political progress, you know, kind of as defined through a series of natural and social laws, right? That mm-hmm. that the universe mm-hmm. is legible to us. This goes back to Newton, you know, and Descartes, and so 17th yeah. century forward. And it does have a kind yeah. of a long and august history. but there are certain excesses, and where you began by pointing to, for example, the mastery over nature to produce comfort. I mean, you know, kind of the problem with that is evident in all kinds of environmental crises we currently face, for example. And there is a kind of a corresponding loss of certitude, a loss of confidence that just because you can think it and calculate it, therefore you fully grasp, understand it. That certainly, I think, is not with us in the same way. Let me ask you this then. kind of following on that, so I'm a literature scholar, and a lot of literature scholars, you know, out there in the world of the humanities, argue that what we need today in response to modernity's crises is not spiritual connection to God as much as a clearer vision in facing, you know, everyday problems, deep problems, you know, inequality, injustice, violence, environmental degradation, and so on. And the answers, they argue, are going to be social and political, you know, and scientific still. In other words, they say we need a practical set of solutions to practical this-worldly problems. Because I'm wondering, do you try to reconcile these two poles, then the spiritual side and the secular side, you know, the turn to God on the one hand with practical attention to the needs of the world on the other? Or do you find there's a tension in there you just can't resolve?
I don't see that as one of the great tensions if we understand things properly. I will say that as a Christian with my understanding of human nature, I must be highly skeptical of how much can be fixed and solved by latent human capacities. I go so far as to say technique and technocracy cannot save the world. I think the Christian prescription requires a much more radical transformation and reorientation of the human self. And the power to do that must come from beyond, or I guess you could say above the self, or collectively ourselves. More than anything else, perhaps, I think the transformation that comes when a person is drawn into proximity to the presence of God lies in escaping from self-interest into the freedom, the relative freedom of self-forgetfulness. And I know there are varieties of spirituality that seem purely escapist and downright irresponsible. But those aren't authentic forms of Christian spirituality. And the reason I say that, Matt, is that my understanding is that union or communion with God, which is the desideratum, is so much more than private personal therapy. What we find, there is an authentic connection to God, is that the divine disposition becomes contagious. And those who move into this sphere of relative proximity to the divine presence find themselves compelled to echo the heart of God. And that means to follow the heart of God into the inconvenient world, because that's where the divine heart is always leaning, as we know from that great central doctrine of the incarnation. It helps to remember as well, I think, that there is what I call an imitative principle running through all true religion. We become like that which we adore. And God so loved the world. If you take a look at the mystics historically, you discover that almost to a person, they were actually very engaged in this world.
That's right.
And this is, in fact, what I find to be the persuasive thesis of a book edited by Janet Ruffing, also of Yale, recently retired from there, entitled Mysticism and Social Transformation. And that book came out 20 years ago, and I think it's still worth a look.
That's fantastic. I'm teaching a class right now, actually, a class I teach on literature and spiritual experience. We read both Christian Wiman and Janet Ruffing, actually. So, yeah. So you're channeling here my class, Glenn, or we're channeling you more like.
I'm preaching to the choir here.
Yeah, you are.
The choir. Yeah.
But this what you say is really important, right? I think that the sense there of desiring some kind of authentic connection to God, what is greater than us, explains so much of the burst of interest in spirituality that we've seen over the past many decades that you write about in this lecture. And there are religious, you know, forms of this, and in that category, religious, Christian forms of spirituality, and you have kind of secular forms of spirituality. And I wonder if you could comment on this kind of claim in your lecture, this sentence. You say, most secularized persons lack a rudimentary vocabulary for processing spiritual experiences and often find classic Christian conceptualizations and terminology meaningless to them. There's a conundrum there, right? Because on the one hand, how do they explain what they seek and what they experience? On the other hand, a long history of explanation in, you know, really quite sophisticated Christian mystical traditions and other kinds of theological writings is unintelligible or undesirable to them. Can you comment on that, on that, on that kind of tension?
Well, this problem is, I think, in part a consequence of growing religious illiteracy, which means that there is a lack of helpful interpretive frameworks for spiritual experience. And my fellow Canadian and philosopher, I'm not a philosopher, he certainly is, Charles Taylor, up at McGill in Montreal, has spoken to this in his magisterial book, A Secular Age, where he actually cites a situation that takes place over years ago in what we now call the Czech Republic, or Czechia, I guess now, where Václav Havel is in jail, and he's got his hour in the prison yard, and he's walking around, and he somehow, he says, I was suddenly and inexplicably touched by love. And Taylor goes on to say that touched, that's about as close as some people today can get to unpacking their spiritual encounters. They were touched, and by touched, they mean something really happened, but then the veil comes down and I'm at a loss to make much more sense of it than just to acknowledge it and say I appreciated it and I value it and treasure it in retrospect. So Charles Taylor is making this observation. And, you know, I and my social science wife and two Chinese scholars have just completed a two-year study of Chinese Christian conversion narratives, and how people who were born without any connection to Christianity came to Christian faith, and whether there was a spiritual dimension to that decision-making process to convert. And we discovered consistently throughout the narratives the very same thing Charles Taylor's talking about, that these Chinese people would attest to, there came a moment when I was deeply touched. Sometimes it would precipitate tears or some emotional reaction. And it was typically triggered by a sense of being enveloped by love. And it was something that they couldn't process with their framework of transactional relationships and quid pro quo dynamics. This love, this self-giving, so inexplicable and gratuitous, they inferred must come from a non-human source. And so I think we have to begin with the people's experience and build from that rather than dump the old interpretive apparatus on them from the top.
That's really fascinating. What a great project. I was moved listening to you talk about that, that sense of being touched by something that felt deeply loving, enveloping that way. That's profound.
It was for them.
Yeah. You know, on the side of secular spirituality, you know, my study of that, there are some terms that are employed there that I found useful even in my own religious setting in talking with students or people in my faith tradition that can help explain, put vocabulary to certain terms, certain experiences that one has in a spiritual vein, terms like ultimacy or the transcendent or fullness of life or intensification. Have any of these terms and concepts or others perhaps helped you better understand your own Christian experience of spiritual things? In other words, is there a value to the secular study of spirituality for a Christian?
Oh, I think there is, Matt. And I think that if you want to label it secular vocabulary, like the examples you've just provided, I think can sometimes, often, highlight or bring into clearer focus certain aspects of the lived Christian experience that we might otherwise have missed, just had under the radar. And they can be catalysts of clarity. The language of human flourishing, for example, right, is a framing that has been very helpful to me in understanding the intent of the Spirit. It's interesting, this may be just a meander you'll need to delete out of the podcast, but I just got back from Texas where I was co-teaching with a Roman Catholic theologian a course on how Catholics and Protestants can minister together to young people. Mm. And they were talking about the fact that in the spiritual experience of young people today, there's less of a hunger for forgiveness and a much more profound yearning for belonging. Hmm. And so this word belonging comes not from the top down, but from the grassroots up. And to listen to that and process that constitutes an invitation to frame the Christian message in much more relevant ways.
That's so interesting. You know, BYU, where I work recently, has made belonging and inclusion a massively important part I mean, there's an office for it actually now at the university to try to reach out and to address these felt needs from our community here at the university. So I find that carryover, that crossover across states and multiple traditions to be really resonant. Yeah. That really rings true to me.
And you know, as you say that, Matt, it makes me realize often what we think is a fresh discovery, like belonging, is actually a rediscovery of something that went down the tank into amnesia. Because I'm thinking in the 1500s of the Heidelberg Catechism, what is your greatest comfort in life and in death? And the children were taught to say that I belong, body and soul, in life and in death, to my faithful Savior, Jesus Christ. So 500 years ago, This was deeply appreciated. This was question number one of the Heidelberg Catechism. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that is amazing. I somehow felt we didn't invent that here at BYU. I had this sticking suspicion, Glenn. That's great.
Can I just say something, kind of a caveat about secular vocabulary?
Yeah, sure.
Some of this language, like the transcendent or the ultimate or the source, as sort of synonyms for God that you know everybody can camp under, I think such language often emerges from an attempt to make interreligious or transreligious generalizations. And the price tag on that is that the riches of the particularity and the uniqueness of a faith tradition can be lost a bit, diluted, glossed over. And it's our contemporary great historian of spirituality, Bernard McGinn, who has explained that the unique interpretive framework that a particular faith tradition provides, with which we process our experiences, actually colors and shapes the experience itself. Yeah. So that at a certain level, similar experiences cannot be lumped together and just thrown willy-nilly into generic folders.
That's a very important point, very well said. I was just thinking the same thing as you were talking, actually, something similar to that, about the way that we describe something and the ways is the way we remember it. And that can modify the experience in hindsight. And you can lose the specificity of what it was that actually was the original, you know, sort of impetus for this, the explanation that follows it. That's great, Glenn. Thank you. So in this lecture, becoming this article, you describe several developments in Christianity that have fostered greater understanding of it and that point to perhaps an outpouring of the Spirit itself. These include, for example, Catholicism's Vatican II Council in the 1960s, or the charismatic Pentecostal movements that emerged in the 1960s also, or a growing sense of Christian ecumenism, and so on and so forth. And that last category, the Christian ecumenism, that really comes close to my own experience. This podcast, for example, is an ecumenical venture, and I often find myself really moved by the spiritual gifts of people with whom I speak. Like today, talking with you, for example, Glenn, is a classic case of that. And I've been moved by things you've said in the past, which is why I was so grateful you agreed to talk with me on the podcast. And I love how you put something. You write that ecumenism, quote, is about more than getting along. There is the prospect of mutual enrichment. We are hearing more now of a receptive ecumenism, one that is open to what the other can offer to fill our own deficiencies. And so the dynamics of the deeper communion can be characterized by holy envy, a longing for that which we see from afar and wish to incorporate into our own lived experience. So I guess my question for you is, do you feel holy envy very often? Like, what, if so, what gives you holy envy?
Well, I feel holy envy. At least I feel envy a lot. And sometimes that even leads to me to describe my relationship to my own tradition as ambiguous belonging. That's a whole nother story. But I'll give you an example of the things that make me envious when I look out beyond the locus of my evangelical tradition. You know, we're big on extemporaneous prayers, and we equate winging it in prayer with sincerity. I envy beautiful set prayers. One of them comes to my mind every morning when I wake. When I first attain consciousness, I go back to a prayer penned by Thomas Ken in the 1700s. Direct control suggests this day, all I design or do or say, that all my powers and all my might in thy soul glory may unite. Mm-hmm. That gives my soul a track to run on. That's better stuff than I've ever written. And so I envy some of these prayers. I don't like it when they become wooden and ritualistic, right. But when they are entered into with sincerity, they're very beautiful. I sometimes sneak out to Episcopal churches for a liturgical fix. I just need that beauty. And the goofiness of a pastor telling jokes gets old after a while. I would just want something short and eloquent and insightful. Thank you very much. I envy deeper patterns of historical continuity. I love the riches of multi-century resources to access. My tradition engages daily in chronological snobbery. If it didn't happen in the last 5 years, who needs it? I envy sacred space. You know, we're a tradition of multi-purpose rooms. Finish the sermon and bring out the basketball hoops. You know, it's just nothing very holy about sacred space. My tradition says you meet God anywhere. Yeah, or you may not. Right, you know. Right. That's a sampling of my holy envy, and yet I know where I belong, and I try to bloom where I'm planted.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's a great list. You actually captured. I resonate with several points on there. You know, one of our guests a few months ago was Tish Harrison Warren, and she'd written a book about Compline, which is not a prayer that's part of my own faith tradition. Yeah, it's great. And I reading her book and then talking with her about that, I really thought there's a beauty to these received prayers, right, in the tradition.
Example. Yeah. Yeah. And, no, that book won an award, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. Didn't it win the Christianity Today Book of the Year Award or something? I think that's where it was. Yeah. At least that's one of its awards. Okay.
But you see, that's significant that an evangelical flagship magazine would award Book of the Year to a book that's obviously an example of holy envy.
Right. Yeah. No, great point. Yeah, great point.
Yep.
That's terrific. No, nothing else. Something else in your essay really took me. Your lecture, I was taken with your remark. It's a brief remark, but you say this: it should go without saying that Christian spirituality cannot validate an arrogant populism that celebrates ignorance and disdains wisdom and expertise. Now, that is precisely, you know, the image of Christianity among many non-Christians, and even many in the Christian community of various denominations, right? Especially in our current political and social moment, which has been so fraught. And you've been a strong voice in denouncing misinformation, you know, and lies embraced in corners of American Christianity, and calling for greater information literacy, calling for moral fortitude to face the challenges that we have and not turn away from them or cover ourselves over in some kind of myth. My question really is this: how have you managed to keep your concern or your frustration from boiling over into outrage or turning you away from the church or from Christians who feel differently than you? How have you managed to still interact with people whose assessment of these very same issues might be very different from your own?
Well, in the spirit of public confession, I haven't been managing that particularly well. I'll say that. But I'll share a few things that represent my better angels on this. I would say that outrage in certain situations is a sign that you still have a moral pulse.
Yeah.
But my friend Gordon Smith has been helpful to me in writing about how these kind of emotions can be valid, but he differentiates them from our emotional home. He says, you know, you have these reactions to this, but this isn't where you allow your soul to rest and take root. This, your emotional home must be a place where you're centered in something other than outrage. And so this dialectic between authenticity but emotional home, I think, has really been helpful to me. A couple of just thumbnail things that are coping mechanisms for me in the midst of frustration with my friends and myself are that there sometimes I go to church with the intent of mission. I'm not here necessarily to enjoy myself deeply. I'm here because I'm called to be a grace-filled witness and to do what little I can do to make it incrementally better. So a missional focus rather than an expectation of soul nourishment helps. Another thing is that, you know, I was raised a preacher's kid, and we learned very early on to be the consummate people pleasers, because Dad's, you know, survival depended on us being compliant, nice people. But I think that if we get a sense that we should anticipate rejection and pushback from some quarters, and so just it comes with the territory. Don't be thrown if some people really don't like what you're saying. That's okay. Don't feel you have to please everybody 100%, and just be a little more comfortable with that. And the other thing is, enter the doors that open for you. Don't blow up doorways. Never beg. And think of that old Solzhenitsyn book, The Oak and the Calf. You know, don't beat your brains out on things that aren't going to move anyway. Recognize that you're always dealing with sort of minority conversions or shifts of a subset, tribes within the larger nation. That brings some measure of peace for me.
That's great wisdom and advice. All three of those things really resonate with me. The first thing you mentioned, that that sense of mission when you go to church to worship and being a grace-filled witness, I think was your phrase. I think that's really powerful because grace-filled witness implies that your source of worship is in a greater source than yourself. It's not. It's in Christ. And I think it's easy in our modern world, in the name of promoting the ways of God, to get in easily with political movements, affiliations, tribes, and to conflate those things. And that's really risky. It seems to me that, at least when I've felt God working in my own life in these things, there's always something which confirms in love God's awareness of me, but also that pushes me to accept a difficult truth, which is a source of growth. That's when you said that, grace-filled witness, I thought, yeah, were that there were more of that in our current moment, we'd be better people as a whole, I've got to say. So we're getting toward the back end here of our conversation. Let me ask you this question. This is a kind of a, it goes to a point on which you end. You know, there's so much angst these days about the fate of Christian colleges and universities, and in some cases about the future of Christianity itself, right? And your lecture concludes on something of a kind of a wistful note, but also a note that I find to be faith-filled and beautiful. You invoke the passage in John chapter 3 where Jesus explains to Nicodemus that we can feel the effects of the wind even when we can't see it directly or know its source. And he's saying we must be born of the Spirit. You must be learned to discern the Spirit even though we can't physically see it. And the Spirit is God's descend, right, in God's own way. And you say in your lecture that all the spiritual developments in play you discussed over the course of the lecture in recent decades seem, I'm quoting you here now, to confirm, as if we needed confirmation, that the Spirit will continue to blow where the Spirit chooses. Now, do you say this in a mood of hopefulness, like a gathering momentum of spiritual outpouring, or resignation at a decline we can't forestall, even if we tried?
Well, that's such a perceptive, nuanced question, Matt, and I really appreciate the way you've sort of set me up with these wonderful questions. Is it hopeful or resigned? I would say it's a bit of both. It's a bit of both. When you're invested in a structure that is being dismantled, that's really destabilizing and uncomfortable. So it's hard. But here's where the hope comes. I got this idea from a popular evangelical writer called Phil Yancey. Like so many other popular evangelical leaders, he started out in youth ministry. But he said at one point about the shift in the center of Christianity from the Middle East, the Mediterranean Basin, Europe, North America, and now to the two-thirds world. He said, the Spirit goes where the Spirit is wanted. Where the Spirit is welcomed. And that really gives us a platform for hope because it says the dispositional posture of our own souls is going to be pretty decisive here. Welcoming of his presence, attuned to his voice, responsive to his will. It's your call, so to speak. I don't think in the life of the Spirit usually comes in sort of an irresistible tsunami. I think it's more like that famous medieval English mystic woman, Julian of Norwich, put it. And this is just one English version of it. But she said, I have discovered over my life that the Spirit is a gentleman. And that does sound so weird. But what she was getting at was the sort of non-forceful, invitational disposition of the Spirit. And I think that there's a great deal of hope in that. It gives us the opportunity to respond from the heart.
What a great perspective. I love that, Glenn. You know, and that phrase, "the spirit is a gentleman." I've got a book coming out. It's a spiritual memoir, and one of the phrases I use that return to is God's gentleness, that gentle quality.
Yes.
It's what you're getting at there that I find so profound and persistent. But it does beckon. You have to kind of move toward it. It's not going to sort of force you into kind of obeisance.
Yeah.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that. Let me ask you one last question.
And it's not effeminate.
Please.
It's not effeminate.
No.
It's quite the opposite. It's a controlled strength.
Yeah, good. Yes. Let me ask you this question to kind of close our interview, our conversation today, which I've loved so much. So when we were in San Antonio a couple months back, we were at dinner, you know, with a large group from the Society for the Study of Christian Spirituality. And you mentioned to me that you're retiring at the end of this year, at the end of the school year, from Bethel Cemetery, or seminary, sorry.
Please.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, right, yeah, right. Wrong kind of Freudian slip here, right? No, but I found that I was kind of melancholy, because I mean, you know, you've worked many years and done so much good, and you've earned a retirement and chances to do new things in it. But I thought, you know, it'll be a loss to our society that you're not, you know, working full-time as a scholar anymore. And I thought, okay, so if I could ask you to share, if there were something you could say by way of encouragement or warning or advice or counsel to those of us who study Christian spirituality or who want to study Christian spirituality, what would that be?
Well, I think my perception is that full-time academic posts are increasingly rare, and full-time teaching faculty are an endangered species. And the future really seems to be more with bivocational callings. You know, I don't know what it's like at your university, Matt, but in the ones that I'm familiar with, even the full-time faculty, so-called, have to pick up an administrative gig here and there to round out their legitimacy. And the whole model of higher ed has grown in administrative positions and atrophied in pure academic teaching positions. So, you know, what's the social activist Saul Alinsky says that the smartest thing you can do is to recognize reality and get it working for you as soon as possible. And part of getting it to work for you, I see in a place like the Center for Pastor Theologians, which has emerged in the last few years, where the PhDs are not hanging on anymore to get those enviable full-time positions. They are in pulpits, but bringing a much higher level of discourse and wisdom to parishes. And you know, in the end, it may be a work of the Spirit to bring the expertise and the gifts of academically qualified people back into this real world of the ordinary folks. So look for those. That would be my recommendation to the next generation. And by being an amphibious creature at home in the academy and the marketplace, that may actually be a good thing for the faith in the long run.
That's good advice. Glenn, it's such a joy to talk with you. You're a noble and wise soul. You're an easy person to love, and thank you for your time and sharing your gifts.
You're far too kind, Matt.
Yeah, no, it's true.
Your bar for flattery is very low.
Yeah, no, that's great. Right. No, it's been a joy. Thanks so much, Glenn.
Oh, you're welcome. My privilege.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Abby Thatcher and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.